Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. I encourage you to go back and listen to some of our great guests that we've had over the last few years. And this week, we're going to be visiting with Christopher Millerick. He is a revenue architect, go-to-market strategist, and expert in partner ecosystem leadership. He is the global vice president of worldwide partner sales, alliances, and hyperscalers at Infoblox. And he has some thoughts he's going to share, lessons that he learned that he's going to pass on to you. And looking forward to today's conversation with Chris. Great to have Chris joining us for our conversation. I appreciate you taking time out of your week to chat.
I'm thrilled to be here, Mark. It's a pleasure to reconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess for our audience, could you give us just a little bit of a flyover of your career and just kind of how you've gotten to where you are today?
Yeah, no, 100%. Thank you for the opportunity to share it. I am, so I've been in technology go-to-market and either sales, direct sales, partner sales, spent a little stint even in product marketing along the way, but really have been focused on, you know, working either directly with customers, leading teams or leading teams of teams to help essentially go out and solve customer problems. And I ideally do it in a way that's profitable and successful for the company that I've been working for. So that's been a big part of it. And I've spent the last 4.5 years for the privilege to lead the partner sales and alliances organization globally here at a company called Infoblox, where a security, cybersecurity, and network services oriented company. You're private equity backed, and it's been a great 4.5 year run. Really, actually, have doubled our ARR in that span of time. So it's been fantastic.
Well, I like to ask this question most every guest. If you're able to go back and talk to that 22-year-old Chris who had a lot, not much life experience yet, what would you give some advice to him, and what would you say to yourself?
Yeah, you know what? I think probably some of the primary advice I would give would be, first of all, actually listen to more advice from the folks around you that probably are in the general age bracket that I'm in now. Sure. I really feel fortunate in terms of having, you know, great mom and dad, looking up to them growing up, and so a lot of those kind of values that get instilled. But then heading off into the workforce, and you know, I went a little bit of a different path into the sales and go to market approach, and so there wasn't necessarily as much direct material experience to be able to share when I was early career. So when I look back, I think about some of the decision frameworks, today that I really lean on when I think about whether it's career opportunities, whether it's decisions in terms of workplace, prioritizing, what needs to get done, how we do it, how we get people on board with it. And then as well, I think about from a personal perspective. I'm super fortunate. I've got a fantastic family, an awesome wife, Allison, and I've got my two kids. My daughter's in high school. My son is a burgeoning high schooler. And so I look at that, and it's, you know, for many of the decisions that I make, ultimately it's, you know, it's a family first framework that I come from and that I espouse within the people that I get to work with and work for me. And at the same time, I think you can have that and drive a performance culture, a sense of urgency and this opportunity to really be in pursuit of the bigger mission. Because it's always on behalf of the folks at home. So it's those are some of the things that I would think about. I would kind of instill one additional thing, which is, you know, I think from an early age, pretty voracious curiosity in all things. Sometimes we kind of laugh at home where it's like, if only all this, you know, random knowledge sitting up between my two ears here could be all used, applied immediately for personal and financial gain. I think there's a dynamic of being a bit of a Renaissance style person in pursuit of many different interests, because that curiosity, when you then apply it into the business world and into certainly go to market, thinking about the influences that our customers are and prospects are essentially being influenced by, and how do you, you know, lace into that when a decision that might, you know, be made in a year or a 2 year sales cycle, or we might only see 6 months of a sales cycle, but that decision started to be shaped a year before. And how do you think about, you know, how do you influence that? And so there's things like that along the way as well. And I think that curiosity framework, and in pursuit of how can we explore this and then what's the process behind it, it does ultimately, it comes back into making good decisions, but it all laces into a framework that I think is important to lean on.
So any advice that you received early on that you, looking back on, you thought, I probably should have ignored that advice?
So, you know, I think, I don't know if it would be advice that I received that I should have ignored per se, but there's probably more of this, like the zeitgeist of the moment where you get this sense that to be successful in business, you have to work at a pace that's going to actually practically, there's no way it doesn't lead to a burnout, right? There's this idea of, you know, it's like, well, you sacrifice. And to an extent, especially in the line of work and in technology sales in particular, but just sales in general, it does lend itself to, you know, a lot of times we recruit from folks that were former athletes, mm-hmm. right? High sense of, you know, either competitive, you know, sense of urgency, personal kind of high bar for performance. And, you know, in many ways, I think that also sets up for scenarios where you kind of forget to focus on actually the things that are controllable, and you start to focus on outcome, right, versus process. And that is, at least in my experience, personal experience as well, but as I've also observed across peers and colleagues and other folks in the business, you know, you can wish and want and try to will the outcome, but at the end of the day, you got to control what's actually in your grasp and drive it and put a process behind it and create that repetition that then leads to the success. And I wish I could say it was overnight. Overnight is luck, right? Repeated is process and excellence. And I think those are the things that, you know, as a young person coming into to the career of sales early on, you know, you essentially look at the scoreboard, right? In terms of who are your top reps, who are this and that. And a lot of times it's like, you know, they say it's the iceberg effect. You're looking at the tip of the iceberg and you're going, oh my gosh, that's the mountaintop. That's the pinnacle. These guys or gals are just unbelievable at what they do. And it's this mystery as to how they got there or what they're doing. Sure. And I think it's when you actually get a little time and experience, you unpack what that mystery is, and it's dedication to process, it's repeatability, it's efficiency, it's passion and urgency, but fueling those frameworks. And then over time, honestly, it makes these folks unstoppable. But when you don't necessarily have that to lean on, you can kind of run on the hamster wheel until you're exhausted and not necessarily know what direction you're going. So I think that would be, you know, advice that, I probably would have ignored had it been formally given, but I think just the environmentals as a young person coming into sales, you know, back in my 20s, which is unfortunately a long time ago, it is something that I think giving, right, that advice today to kind of counter the trap of falling into this, like, well, I can just will the outcome if I just keep working hard and keep working hard and keep working hard. Yep, you got to do that. You got to work smart too. And working smart shouldn't be a mystery, because there are frameworks that are there to go reach out, grab, and apply. And you'd be shocked. Yeah, yeah. The one thing I would also share is advice I would give to my 22-year-old self is be patient, but also be persistent, right? Don't use patience to let yourself off the hook. Be persistent, be resilient, be gritty, but allow the process to actually, right, take hold and pull you forward. You know, there is a certain DNA in many a salesperson that's a little impulsiveness. I don't know anything about that personally, of course, you know, from my early days. But I do think there's there is a patience that really is important, because you got to let the process actually work. You got to have the patience with it. So that's my, what I would tell myself. And now I can just be curious to say, would I listen? Yeah, I hope I do.
Yeah, that's true.
I hope I would.
So you've mentioned kind of a decision framework. How would you define a decision framework, and why do leaders need one?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think in terms of why leaders need decision frameworks to lean on, and I'd argue decision frameworks that they're not hidden, right? They're actually, we share what the frameworks are, share what your thought process is, how it is that you think about assessing situations, problems, right? Organizational design, right? Whatever it might be, kind of how do you enter into that to assess what good looks like, right? As a starting point. And then when you think about changes that you might want to make, again, how do you think about initiating changes? How do you think through that? And then how do you communicate and get folks on board with it? Mm-hmm. Right? I think there's a dynamic sometimes that as you grow within an organization, there's always the risk of forgetting where you came from, right? And forgetting that we all started as individual contributors, right? We all started as folks, maybe in the sales case, I go back to my early days, essentially, you know, just an inside sales rep banging away on the phones and trying to work my way up into the field and then be a field sales rep. And then it was like, just keep kind of ratcheting up on this career progression. And there were many times when I think back on decisions that might've been made in the organization I was with. And listen, I had the privilege to work at some great organizations as well. So it's, you know, when I kind of think about that, and I go, well, even inside of these great organizations, sometimes decisions might have been made at an executive level or at a senior level, and they just kind of get passed down, like the tablets have come down from the mountaintop, and this is what we shall do. And you don't understand necessarily the rationale, the logic behind it. And I think about then the time and the cycles that go into folks kind of consternating over why a decision was made, as opposed to coming in right from the outset and going, here is essentially the current state. Here's the case for change. Here's what we're thinking. Right now, these are the options that we had in front of us. This is the path that we think is going to be the best return for the company, for you, for our customers, for our partners. Right now, here's how we're going to think about operationalizing it. And then actually, and part of that is right from the get-go, you have a framework like that. That framework can be applied at the kind of inception stage of, we have to assess where we are and do we need to make some changes? Is there kind of a stop, start, change, or modify kind of process that we're going to need to apply here? But that can start within the small group of senior leaders, executive leaders. It can then extend to the extended leadership team, and then ultimately it can make its way through the entire organization. And I think, you know, the biggest takeaway I would have in thinking about effective decision frameworks is that they need to be shared, right? And kind of embraced, frankly, within the organization, because the more you can do that, you know, it's like, it's something I did get shared with me early in my career, where I was like, the measure of a leader isn't the title. It's when the leader turns around, is anybody following? Mm-hmm. Right. And there's a dynamic in these decision frameworks that set the stage for, hey, we're going to make some decisions, right? And sometimes they're going to be challenging decisions, right? Could be market context, could be things happening in the business, competition. There's a whole host of challenges that businesses face. And part of the effectiveness of that decision is, how quickly will it get implemented? How quickly does this great new idea actually come to life and become the fabric of the organization? And that time between where we are today to where we say we should be, right? If that's months, quarters, years for that to culturally become a part of the fabric, yeah, the amount of lost time and value you can't replace. And so I think that's like, there's a why behind this, which is, you have a great idea. Well, ideally, you want folks to embrace it and go act on it. But if folks don't have a real connection to it and conviction behind it, it, you know, the likelihood that they're going to slow roll the adoption is very high. And that's, you know, again, that's, you see that obviously across many organizations. There's not a, nothing unique in this, but I do think, you know, what's probably not revolutionary advice could be adopted more ubiquitously across the industry. It just, it's a way to move teams forward faster. So
do you have like a template that you use in your decision framework? Do you use different? Give us a little example of how that looks.
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, I think about, and I've used it, I've even used it recently with some of our organizational planning for our upcoming fiscal year. And we're a healthy 6 months ahead of that timeline, which is good. But, you know, a big part of it is kind of the current state assessment, right? In line with the mandate or are the objectives for the business, both in the current year and then in the out year, right? What's coming, as much as we have insight into that, and kind of go, okay, assessing how we're executing, but then really all of the, from a partner ecosystem perspective, just as much as I would from a direct ecosystem perspective, I'm trying to think through essentially the revenue lifecycle of my customer base from, you know, that early, that early inception point, the influence that might lead us to generate a lead, right? Could come to us from a partner, could be organic to the company, but all the way through then to our sales process, to the implementation, the realizing of value of what we've sold, and does the customer actually experience what we sold them on in practicality? Because most companies today, especially obviously in the SaaS world, it's an ARR, you know, the world that we live in. So you're only as good as the number of customers that choose to continue the relationship beyond the first year. So it's like you get your first time sale and it's fantastic. But you need to then make sure that they realize value because it's the renewal, it's the cross-sell, it's the upsell. And so thinking through that full landscape and going, all right, I have X number of resources that, you know, and people that I can deploy to go engage with these customers against this addressable market. Awesome. Now, how do I think about all the influence that lives outside of our walls and the partner communities and the influence that they, that these customers may hear from? And how can I essentially shape a favorable outcome for the company by crafting a really strong customer experience through the process? Yeah. And a big part of that is also thinking through the, of all these influence points out there, partner community, our sellers, marketing, right? Branding, message and reputation to market. When we think about trying to change that for the better, right? We've got great, you know, great value that we with inside the walls, right, can recognize, but that doesn't mean that anybody outside the walls, you know, gravitates to it or understands it. I think a lot of it comes back to at every step of the way in the decision framework is what's in it for them, right? And you kind of go, okay, whether it's in the early stage of a sales cycle and you're thinking about lead generation and demand gen and activities and events that you might want to go drive, what's in it for them being all parties involved? How do they benefit, right? Mm. And can I articulate that? And can my teams articulate that? Because if they can, the likelihood that somebody is going to vote with their time to invest in our company and our product and our message out to the market, to their customers, significantly higher, right? It's this is kind of the type of thing that if I have to make a partner or a customer guess as to why it is we're talking, we're already at a deficit. Right. Mm-hmm. So I want to be as crisp and articulate to that. But then to do that, I look across the full framework and I have to essentially assess how strong is that value proposition, and not from our own lens, but from the outside in. Right. Because no matter what we say as an ISV, we're essentially going to be ranked. And, you know, and the ranking is, all right, priority given to us versus the hundreds of other companies vying for customer time, for partner time. And I think if we're, you know, you're trying to set up a scenario where you can go get your unfair share of that time, it's got to be compelling. And it likely has to be compelling in slices, because you never get, you know, you never get the, oh, let's just, can we do a deal today? Like, that's not how it works, right? It's 14, I think the statute's about 14 touches before a sale is made. That's actually when you're in the sales process. All the stuff before that, I mean, you could be upwards of double that. So there really is this dynamic of how do you think about creating a value proposition that's very clear for benefit, what's in it for them, for all of the people that have to participate in it. The only way you can possibly wrangle that together is to have a really sound set of decision frameworks that can guide it, that can inform, and that ideally can create the buy-in where folks go, I can participate in this. I actually understand how to work with you, right? I know what the objective is, but now I know how to work with you to support the objectives, regardless of where I am in the business. And that's, I think, a big part of the lessons that I've taken on why decision frameworks are so important is because, you know, sales, well, sales isn't a silo. Sales in the partner context. Well, okay, you get that. Now it was marketing. Marketing's never in a silo, right? There's branding, there's messaging, there's customers, there's feedback. This, it's like you start going down the line and at a leadership level, so much of what we do, if you do it effectively, requires a really strong cross-functional grasp. And the better I also have these frameworks in place, it's a little bit of kind of, I have to understand the whole to influence my piece, but it gives me an opportunity to invite folks into that frame and hopefully create a winning outcome for them. So they want to continue to contribute to it. Right? So this is kind of like, there's a dynamic in that, but when we both can sit on the same side of the table and look at a framework and then think about how we're going to go execute against it, it's just the opportunity to create common language so much faster. So,
yep. So in that decision framework, is there a framework that you use when you're hiring? A lot of our listeners are new leaders or first-time CEOs. What framework do you use in that process?
Yeah. So it's, I cannot claim to have, built this particular framework. And thankfully, you know, given the power of our virtual audience here, I happen to have a book with me, but I use Who Hiring.
Okay. Right? Yep.
GH Smart, both Who Hiring and I'm going to sit here and be a full on advertisement for these guys, but then also PowerScore is the other book. They're quick reads, but in terms of the hiring frameworks, you know, what I would tell you, it's actually incredibly comprehensive. So it's for some organizations, if this is not how they have hired, or this is, you know, it can be like almost like a tidal wave of process and rigor around it. I think the biggest thing, you know, I kind of take away from this is I'm trying to evaluate for obviously intellect, right? I'd say motor in terms of the drive, the sense of urgency that they have, grit and resiliency in the context of teams, right? Not just individual, but also from a team framework and being able to articulate that through the process, right? In terms of, and you know, people tell stories and it's great to be able to then, again, use a framework to be able to listen and really listen actively in the stories that a candidate will tell to understand, okay, because obviously everybody in the interview, it's the best version you will ever see of that person. No question about it. Everyone is on best behavior. And so you listen for it. But I think what I'm always listening for is a combination of the stories resonate, right? Are they believable to me in terms of that this person actually had this experience? Is there credibility behind it? And then as well, when I think about, you know, then very much into the personal framework of what's going on in the company, what's with the role that we're hiring for? Is this person going to be able to come in? You know, level of humility is an important dynamic in folks you work with. So being able to, you know, have an openness, a curiosity to understand how things have been, how the current process, you know, exists today. What does that look like? What are the benefits? What are some of the shortcomings? What are some of the things that potentially with this hire we might be looking to enhance by putting someone new in the role, and then really saying, okay, yeah, ultimately you got to be able to pick up the phone and go, you've told me your story, I love it. Now, who would you recommend I talk to hear your story from them? Right, that referenceable base is also such an important dynamic, because obviously, yeah, everyone's going to put the best foot forward out there. Nobody's going to come in and go, and by the way, I do have a couple of, you know, there's a couple of shadows out there you should be aware of, right? This is like, you want to be able to go out and understand, you know, because you don't work with a resume, you work with a person. Ultimately going to collaborate with somebody that's going to be three-dimensional, and it's you know, and you kind of get a flat read to start, right? Depending on what you're evaluating in a candidate. But I do think it's, you know, the last thing I would say in terms of from a hiring perspective is the opportunity to actually challenge yourself to look outside of just the comfort level of your own network too. Right now, obviously I've been fortunate, and I think about that in terms of my network has, you know, has grown over the years. And it's pretty comprehensive. If I kind of look, you know, 2-3 degrees out within the network, you're only a phone call away, you know, to really kind of get a chance to understand somebody's experience, successes, you know, anything that, you know, learning curve and development that a person has, because, you know, I am also a proponent of the fact that, you know, like that constantly curious, continually learning mindset. Somebody's experience, you know, a decade ago, very different, right, than what they bring to the table today, and vice versa. You know, massive successes, you know, that are in the past aren't always a predictor, right, of the future. So you're really going to kind of make sure you're meeting the person and understanding it's why now for them, for this opportunity, right? And kind of an understanding, connecting the what's in it for them. What do they hope to gain from it? What, in their words, what do they believe that they can contribute? And then what does it look like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years for them? Asking those types of questions, as much as we're trying to solve for a need in the business today, understanding where does this fit, right, for them? And you know, especially folks that are either mid-career or even earlier career, thinking through and painting the picture as to, you know, because it's always a two-way audition, right? Every interview is a two-way audition for it, right? We're selling on why the company is outstanding. You should come join us. And at the same time, we're assessing for the talent to see if there's a fit. But that idea that, you know, if you look 2 years out, 3 years out, and where do you see yourself, and making sure that we're tying the experience that you'll actually have and materially demonstrate in this role is going to actually fuel that journey as well, right? And connecting with that early in the interview cycle, I think, is an important thing, because, you know, as much as depending on who which market you're looking at, where we are, and obviously the impact of AI right now throwing everything into flux as to what job prospects look like, the best candidates still have options. And if you want to hire, right, the high caliber candidate, you got to connect mission and meaning in those conversations just as much as you're matching for the experience, right? There's kind of the table stakes of the experience, the capabilities, but then can you match mission and meaning? Because that's where all of a sudden folks will power through, you know, if the going either gets tough, or it might be, you know, there's an aspect of, you know, of the business that they have to lean into over and above. So that's my perspective on it.
Well, you've answered one of my questions in advance around books that you recommend to your leaders. You've got a couple there on your desk. Any others that you've put on the list, reading list?
I do, actually. I've got so the GH Smart guys are fantastic. I have I actually have three other books that I keep on my desk, and they're partially as just a reminder, because I took some great lessons away from them, and so they kind of keep me grounded. But I will share. The Dichotomy of Leadership. This is Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. So these two gentlemen, Navy SEAL commanders and operators, they wrote Extreme Ownership probably, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. Thought it was a great book. But what I found was with the Dichotomy of Leadership, the idea of this dichotomy of you have an absolute accountability framework, right, as a leader, and yet at the same time you need to empower others to be successful, to essentially foster the kind of accountability and ownership that you personally feel. And so there's this dichotomy of, you know, really kind of leading the team and then setting the example, but then letting them go off to be able to go execute, and then creating, I would argue, a coaching style culture in the framework of how you lead. And so there's tons of good lessons in that one. From a sales perspective, just coming in, if you're an early seller, or you're thinking about, or certainly in an entrepreneurial space, trying to actually think about how you connect what it is that you're trying to sell into the words that will actually move people, you know, kind of intrinsically and emotionally to be like, well, I don't know if I've got budget for that, but I got to figure out how I do, because this really seems like I can't miss. And that's Oren Kleff, Flip the Script. Awesome, awesome book. I think this was his second one. I think his first one was Pitch Anything, and really, really good. And then the last one is I read more recently, and I thought about it because, you know, it's funny. I think some of the folks that you know, that are close to me would be like, there's no way that you're going to be accused of being an introvert. And yet at the same time, to an extent, a little bit introverted. But in the profession of sales, it's like, you know, you're an evangelical introvert. You can put those two complete opposites under one roof. And so this book, Smart, you know, but Not Loud. Awesome, right? Perspective for folks that are a little bit more introverted and thinking about how do you, you know, how do you materially, A, get noticed for the right reasons, right? For the contributions you make, that you could make, right? When you may not have in your DNA, you know, organically, that desire to kind of elbow the person out of the way to make sure your voice is heard, right? So there's that dynamic of going, you know, how do you let your work speak louder when there's no way in today's day and age that it'll ever speak for itself, right? It's you have to advocate for yourself, but how do you think about doing that? And again, the thing I love about it, Jessica Chen is the author of that book. It's frameworks, right? It's frameworks to think about, you know, how do you do this? And I'm a big proponent of, probably in the personal life, I'm a big proponent of the many YouTube tutorials out there. I think I've done more handiwork around my home and saved a couple of bucks. And, you know, but it is, you know, I think, you know, really, you know, I kind of grasp personally to the fact that, you know, anything can be learned. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden I'm going to make up for the fact that I'm not 7 feet tall and can't play in the NBA, but any skill you can go out and acquire to a level of at least proficiency in pursuit of mastery. And if you think about this from whether it's go to market, sales, you treat it like a craft, you really lean into it and you go, I you know, I'm not going to step into the workforce at 22 and all of a sudden be up, you know, giving keynotes in front of 10,000 people. But I remember going to a Cisco Live event when I was probably mid-career. I was at EMC for about 12 years back in the early part of my career. And I had a chance to go out to Cisco Live. I was leading an alliance relationship for us. And it was one of John Chambers' last kind of pitches out to his audience before he had retired. And I watched him present, you know, essentially Pastor John up there evangelizing to the audience. And it was outstanding in the audience. And I'm watching this guy and he's could not be more conversational. And it's like, we're all in his living room, essentially. There's just 15,000 of us, right? Just awesome. And so I walk, you know, the thing ends and you know, people clear out and I'm like, I'm just going to walk up and kind of take a look at this and see what he was looking at as he's doing this. So I walk up and what I see, what he's looking at is yes, the audience, but there's tape on the ground. There's things blocked out. He's got monitors. And so part of this is to go, yeah, you can learn to be conversational in front of 15,000 people. Doesn't mean that it's going to be comfortable in the learning curve, but it's a skill that can be acquired, right? And just as so many things are, and then a little luck and timing helps along the way for career success. But if you match the skills and you have a never-ending sense of urgency behind it, and you bring that hustle, you do end up making your own luck.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. And I think you mentioned some books. I don't think they have been mentioned yet, which is a feat at this stage. So that's great. So any quotes that you refer to?
Yeah. You know what? I have a few. I have two that are laminated and set up on my wall. So I'll give you the first one, which is, this one probably has been referred to in past. I feel like these ones might be a little bit more, you know, off the main card, but Winston Churchill, right? So, you know, success is not final and failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. I think that's that's not a bad set of words to live by. And also keep you grounded, right? You could be flying high one moment, but you got to recognize that you're only as good as your next decision. There's always the next decision. And that also plays out if you screw up, if you make the wrong choice. You have the opportunity to take a step back and think about what's your next move. And it's a sequence. And ultimately that gets you there. The last quote, that might be a little deeper, but because it's Confucius. Okay. And it's every man has two lives. And the second starts when he realizes that he has just one. Mm. And so that one, I can't claim to be the originator of this. Obviously, I got Confucius, so it kind of goes back a little bit into history. But I heard that. Actually, I heard that on a podcast probably 15 years ago. Mm. And it just stuck with me. And I think as I've gotten a little bit older, and my kids have gotten a little bit older, it actually resonates more and more. In terms of like, that might actually be right up there with advice I would have given to my 22-year-old self. Maybe wouldn't have been able to grasp it at the time.
Sure. Yep.
But those are my absolutely. Two.
Outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Yeah, I am. Family ultimately is a big one for me. And I'm super fortunate. To not only have my family, my wife and both of my kids, have the opportunity to be active in their lives and the many activities that they've got going on. But, you know, a great extended family as well. And my folks are, thankfully, still here and very active. And so it's fantastic. And likewise with my in-laws. And then beyond that, it's, you know, I do think there's a dynamic of, and maybe it's a bit of because of the idea of treating your career as a craft. You gotta stay in shape, right? I mean, ultimately, you gotta stay mentally sharp. You gotta stay physically sharp. And so, I do have the benefit of working out a fair amount, and you know, the whole sauna, cold plunge, all that crazy stuff kind of keeps either keeps me tapped or it's keeping me sharp and close to the edge. But it is part of the routine that I find to be outstanding because it's. Yeah, you get a chance to meditate, do things like that as well. Just stay grounded in the why you do what you do every day. And then beyond that, it's kind of getting back into it. Used to do a little competitive jujitsu and things like that, and some martial arts and things like that. So all fun stuff. And I would love to say that I love to get out and play golf. I actually love to. I find that my golf these days is almost predominantly customer or partner oriented golf events. So it's sure. I essentially show up and I'm like, all right, well, I will be your entertainment for this afternoon. I want to make sure that you have a comfortable round and anything you feel bad about in your game, you can look to me and I will make you feel confident. This is my foil for anybody that has a lack of confidence in their swing or golf game. I'm here to help. You can just have a look and just don't follow anything I do, but it's never a long walk spoiled. I do enjoy getting out and in the camaraderie of it.
Good. Parting advice you'd give to a new or up and coming leader.
Yeah, I think, there's probably two pieces of advice when I think through it. First, recognize the privilege that is actually embedded in leadership. At the end of the day, it doesn't boil down to simple career pursuit. Like I want to lead, I want to be a vice president of sales, or I want to be a CRO, or I'd like to be a CEO, whatever. Awesome from the perspective of personal goals to go have. But recognize along the way what that actually means. I want to be a CEO or a CRO or a VP of sales or whatever it might be. I want to go lead an organization filled with people that hopefully, if we do this right, and we lean on, good decision-making and process around that, we're going to be able to create a ton of value, not just for the customers that we serve, but for the employees that serve them. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think sometimes, especially, and I'm going to say high ARR growth pressure, complemented by deep OPEX pressures to keep expenses in line, right? Those things absolutely are table stakes, but you got to lead with a soul. And you got to make sure that then the mission that supports the growth and the how you do it to hit those types of metrics connect with the people that are inside the walls of your company And it's not somebody else's job. It's yours at any level of leadership, whether it's you're a team leader, you got a couple of folks working for you. Make sure that that experience they have working for you is one that they would tell their friends, they would follow you to another company.
Sure.
That would like your leadership should transcend the logo on your business card. That would be my kind of opening advice to a young leader. And then the flip side of that is, you know, it doesn't hurt to be obviously confident in the direction you're going, but humble in the fact that you could be wrong. And so take some time to really assess, right? And to take feedback, even from in organizations. Many times, you know, you got folks that we'll either we might bring in from the outside as new leaders, or they're a younger leader that's coming up and stepping into a role for the first time. Ultimately, the opportunity, unless it was an organically created leadership role, somebody else had it before you did. And so understanding a little bit of the diagnostic as to, well, why did this role open up? Right, the person transitioned to something bigger and better, and that was the, you know, that's the always the best, you know, kind of framework for that. Or was somebody top rated, right? And understanding, you know, not just from the lens of, oh, you know, that person that was there before, they didn't do this, this, and this. That's not going to be a problem here with this new leader, and I'm going to absolutely get after it. But actually going, well, what was the kind of the next question behind where they fell short? Right? Why was that a challenge? Because make no mistake, you hop right into the saddle and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and it's great. And you go, you have the same challenges, just sitting waiting for you as you hop in. So really taking some of that time to try to understand a bit of the why, success or failure, you know, kind of preempted you coming into the role is super important because it helps you then set the strategy and then the tactics behind it that you're going to have to go put to work so that you don't fall into the same trap.
Yeah.
So those are my two takeaways. Again, like all advice, free and non-obligatory. So.
Well, Chris, thanks again for all your insights. It's been helpful for those listening. And how would somebody connect with you if they'd like to reach out?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Mark. Listen, if anybody wanted to reach out on LinkedIn, and I'm sure if you have a show note, you can throw my profile in there. You can message me on that platform. I'm also affiliated with Hubble, which is an advisory network that we can throw in there as well. But yeah, this is what's the good of having advice and experience to give if you don't give it? So I'm more than happy to share. And like I said, it's always free and non-obligatory. So it's anybody that's interested in reaching out or connecting, please do so.
Great. Well, thanks and wish you continued success and look forward to staying in touch.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.